Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. We are Amal and
Jyotsna.
We are foreign policy enthusiasts interested in understanding China.
Today we will be talking about Xinjiang, that one province of China Imran Khan has never heard about.
Despite being reminded of multiple times. So apart from Imran Khan's lack of memory, why are we talking about Xinjiang? Well, I mean, apart from the fact that it has been in the news all the time, but in all seriousness, it is actually where the strong arm of the CCP is most clearly visible, that is where CCP crushes the population as much as it can, pretty much. Or well, it can actually crush more, but that is the worst case that we see. Some people even say that that is the model which CCP is going to implement everywhere in China. And currently, it's also known as China's Kashmir, according to some observers.
So, how we go about this episode? We'll first talk about the relevance and history of Xinjiang up until the time when it was incorporated into the PRC in 1949. And then we'll discuss some of the factors that have been driving the conflict in modern-day Xinjiang and how China has been cracking down on the Uyghurs who live there. We'll talk about internment camps, about sinicizing Islam, and pushing people into forced labor.
Awesome. So let's get into history first. So Xinjiang literally translates to new land. That sort of implies that it's not really originally part of China, but it was occupied maybe at various points of time, despite what CCP might claim that it has been a historical part of China. But according to their own naming, it is new land for them. So it was first invaded by the Han Empire in the first century BC as part of the Han-Xiongnu War, which is, like, these days the most famous representation of that is in the movie Mulan, where Mulan as the woman goes to fight against the Xiongnu people, also known as the Huns in some way, and somehow poses as a man in that movie. I mean, I haven't watched the movie, but in the older Disney movie, that was how it was. So basically, the traditional China is typically what you get defined by the Great Wall. Beyond that is basically what they have called the barbarian lands. And roughly, this is where, for example, the city of Xi'an is very close to that. And usually beyond, like if you go further west, you see that the terrain is actually rather inhospitable for any sort of a settled civilization. Like there are no major rivers and not lots of agricultural land. So that's why you would find nomadic tribes living there. That is kind of similar to, let's say, Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And this would sort of comprise modern-day Mongolia, parts of Siberia, and a large part of modern-day China, actually, including the provinces of Gansu, Xinjiang, and Inner Mongolia. Now, these tribes would often get together to fight different Chinese empires, sort of raid them, get money, etc. Typical stories of history. And this was typically exemplified by the Han-Xiongnu War. Now, the Han movements were superseded by the Tang Dynasty roughly 700 years later, where they again invaded Xinjiang and actually ended up occupying even parts of Central Asia, like even modern-day Tajikistan, the Fergana Valley, etc. It was the Tang Dynasty which had kicked out much of the Turco-Mongol population back then, which sort of forced modern-day, like, Babur's ancestors were probably living somewhere in Xinjiang. We don't know. But they were probably pushed out at that point of time.
Oh, the turn of history for Pakistan.
Yeah, that's true. So that's why if you look at it from a broader perspective, like from the security standpoint, Chinese empires have always tried to ensure that these outer regions are under control. Because either somebody from these regions invades them or somebody coming over through these regions invades them. So that's why they try to use these as buffer zones in case an invasion comes in. And like Tibet is a similar occupation because that's a supposed buffer zone. And they also try to make sure that the people living in the buffer zones do not invade themselves. So they try to create a loyal population. One of the things they have done is to place more Han people in those areas for the last, I guess, 2000 years, but they still do that. And that's why that local Han population doesn't rebel and the main Chinese population east of the Great Wall remains safe. Now, after the Tang Dynasty, Xinjiang was again occupied about 1,000 years later, and this time by the Qing Dynasty in the 18th century. In fact, that was actually like northern Xinjiang was actually occupied by the by a Mongol tribe known as the Dzungars, who were actually wiped out literally in a genocide. And Uyghur Muslims were placed there who were kind of loyal to the Qing at that point of time. And now CCP wants to maintain that status quo, which led to the PLA moving into Xinjiang in the 1940s.
So because, like you pointed out, Xinjiang forms part of some of these outer frontiers, which bordered these strategic regions where China wanted significant presence in, Mao had his eyes on Xinjiang for some time, from the very beginning when the PRC was established. In fact, he'd even inquired about the presence of oil reserves in the region. At that time, the region was largely controlled by the rival nationalists, who had some sort of power-sharing arrangement in place with the representatives of the former Second East Turkestan Republic, which was a de facto independent state aligned with the Soviet Union. The incorporation of the region into China happened as a result of military advancement led by Peng Dehua and the successes of the PLA in the neighboring Gansu province and elsewhere in northwest China. But several other factors held the CCP here. First of all, the CCP was successful in co-opting its former rivals, the nationalists. Some 100,000 nationalist troops joined the PLA during this time. Secondly, the leadership of the East Turkestan Republic just vanished into thin air, quite literally, because these leaders suspiciously died in an air crash before they had negotiated the terms of the accession with the CCP. And then the invasion of Xinjiang was difficult. In fact, even within the party, it was expected that the territory won't be annexed in 1949 and the annexation would happen only in 1950s or 1951. This was because the leadership was able to identify several challenges annexing Xinjiang. PLA troops were still fighting in Shaanxi, Gansu, and Qinghai provinces. Xinjiang was too distant. There was no reliable means of transportation. The weather was turning cold, and the troop morale was low. So here, the help came from the Soviet Union in form of transport aircrafts, aviation fuel, and 10,000 tons of grains. In fact, the USSR had been advising the CCP on acquiring Xinjiang from the beginning and had assured the party of its support. Soviet Union suggested that the CCP give Xinjiang some form of autonomy to allow the independence movement there to die a slow death. What the Soviet leadership hoped to gain from all this is a subject of continuing debate. It seems likely that the USSR under Stalin saw a mix of economic and security guarantees in Xinjiang as a return for the help they offered. They provided assistance in order to perhaps create an amicable environment for later negotiations with the PRC. So, Amal, fast forward.
Yep. So, coming to the decade of 2000s, the economy of China has not been functioning properly, and one of the things that the policymakers expect is some sort of revolt, or at least some sort of anger towards the government. Now, because the Xinjiang people have typically, or the Uyghurs, have been rather away from the Han population, the CCP leaders fear that they might just revolt. So, and like similar to Tibet actually, that they might just follow a different set of ideas than those imposed by the CCP, because, well, they're not as loyal as the regular Han people, according to the CCP. So therefore, out of sheer insecurity, the CCP did what it has typically done, or in fact other Chinese empires have done, simply sinicize the population, quote-unquote, and to make them loyal. So you might expect a government would try to, like, what would they try to do? Like, they would try to listen to their concerns, make sure their needs are heard, make sure that they get economic opportunities, they get the right to speak, but, wait, I'm just kidding. This is CCP we are talking about. So they put the entire population or large parts of them into re-education camps where they get quote-unquote re-educated. They forced Islamic religious preachers to dance, to drink alcohol, even eat pork. That is stuff they are typically forbidden to do. And basically that counted as a huge amount of human rights violations, which Jyotsna will talk about. And so the broader point here is that empires have always operated from the rabid support of different ethno-linguistic groups. Typically one ethno-linguistic group has had one empire, even in Indian history, actually. So that's why China is trying to quote-unquote harmonize them by putting them through quote-unquote re-education. Like, just imagine those nice fluffy words like harmonize and educate and basically just crash and just crush them and then make them loyal. Yeah,
a lot of wordplay here. And, you know, enter Islam, a religion of the book that demands submission to Allah or to God. For the CCP, there is no God. The only devotion that you can offer is to the party chief and to the party. So the party sees Islam as a belief system which is incompatible with Chinese life, in the People's Republic. They haven't technically banned Islam, but they are trying to create a party-compatible version of it. Just like they're trying to create a party-compatible version of Buddhism, or Tibetan Buddhism even, where they pick and choose who's going to be the next Dalai Lama. So, but with Islam, they take it far ahead. There is prohibition against praying at home if you have, say, friends or guests over. The CCP has identified 75 signs of quote-unquote religious extremism, which includes completely normal behavior like growing a beard, praying in public places, or even giving up smoking or drinking. Women are sometimes detained because of transgressions by their husbands or sons, and are often made to sleep with male officials as part of this mind transformation, ideological transformation.
Wow.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. There was a media report about that. Then they've banned some of these Muslim names, such as Islam, Quran, Saddam, Mecca. I don't know whether there are actual people who are named after those, but yeah, some version of that. Definitely not Saddam. Saddam's not a good name, I guess. So these names are all unacceptable to the ruling Communist Party, and if your child has one of those names, you'd get denied some privileges, state privileges. So what happens in these internment camps, and how does the CCP ensure the mind cleansing of Uyghurs? If you're a Uyghur who's been detained, you'll be made to listen to lectures about how great the party is and how great Xi Jinping is. You'll be made to sing songs praising the party and write quote-unquote self-criticism essays about how bad of a radical who's believed in a wrong faith you've been. You'll be singing rousing patriotic hymns in Chinese. And when I say patriotic, you know, I mean that the faith is deposed with the party. You know, songs such as, without the Communist Party, there would be no new China. And those who are not able to remember the lyrics are denied breakfast.
You know what?
Yeah.
Like one of the, this just reminds me of Sacred Games, where CCP is saying, kabhi kabhi to lagta hai aapko bhagwan. It's that they are gods in their own
that lives. Is so true. Yeah. Yeah, there are Mao shrines, you know, which are replacing Buddha shrines in China. So, yeah, that's true.
Yep.
They've been implementing discipline requirements for basic things like waking up, you know, taking a roll call, washing, going to the toilet, organizing, housekeeping, eating, studying, sleeping, even closing the door. China has been selling a very different narrative to its own population about what's going on in Xinjiang. Although the authorities frequently describe the internment camps as schools, they also liken them to hospitals, because China treats religious beliefs and Islam as a pathology, an ideological virus that needs to be contained through this sort of treatment that is offered in these hospitals, which are internment camps. Often, these camps are also called vocational training centers for inmates, where inmates provide cheap labor. They're made to attend training and indoctrination courses for weeks or months, and are then assigned to stitch clothes and make shoes, sweep streets, and fill other jobs.
Wow. Okay, this is crazy. Like, literally controlling every single step they do in their daily living.
Yeah.
And sort of forcing them to do things they don't want to do is just amazing. Like, I don't know how somebody would end up being loyal to the party except maybe some sort of Stockholm syndrome. So, moving on to the current day, like, what is the latest spicy news or, like, the most disheartening news we have seen? Is that, like, one Australian group called ASPI, they broke a news that Uyghurs are being used as forced labor in different manufacturing firms, actually supplying to famous brands. So some 80,000 Uyghurs, I think in the last couple of years or so, have been forced to work in different factories which supply to major known brands like Nike, Samsung, H&M, Mercedes-Benz, etc. That is, they have those re-educated people, quote-unquote, from that prison camp in Xinjiang were moved to another prison camp in, like, coastal China, nearby there. And they have been forced to work there in, according to their own admission, a semi-military style, where basically they're just forced and made to produce whatever production happens there. You might think this is uncalled for. This is very inhuman. How can a society survive if they do this? But think again, this is the CCP we are dealing with. There's a bit of an economics lesson here that for any society to grow economically, I mean any modern nation state with, you know, basic freedoms, etc., you need to improve productivity by adopting more and more technology. And that's what is called a good economic model. For econ nerds here, that's the Solow's model. So, in other words, every single person, if they have access to more technology, they produce more thanks to that. And therefore, they do not really need to do slave labor. They can spend much less time in the day and produce more in that process. But that rule doesn't apply to China. China doesn't really have any other economic model except using cheap labor and then trying to, you know, undercut pricing in other places. So initially, or rather for the last few decades, they have been doing that by, you know, running factories in the coast and getting the poor Han people from middle China, that is inner China, and those are known as the migrant laborers. And they come over to the coast, work, and that increases the wealth of the rich people on the coast, actually. So, but now what has happened is that those Han people have started demanding more rights. And because of the salary, like the broader per capita income going up in China, they are demanding a higher salary. And that has started to be rather difficult for the manufacturers. So China said, okay, wait, let's get some more slaves, some different and cheaper slaves. So they simply shifted over to using Uyghurs in prison camps. That is, they just force them and only give them food, like no freedoms at all in life. And that's CCP for you.
This was also happening to Tibetans who were detained for possessing a Tibetan flag. Then, you know, you'd see them in prisons manufacturing toys or clothes or whatever. Yeah, that's CCP for you.
It's just sad.
Mm-hmm. So that's all for today, guys. More on China in our next episode, where we'll be covering China's economic policies, both internal and external. Do send us your feedback and comments. We'll link our Twitter below in the description. Also, feel free to send us questions that you'd like to see addressed. If you like this podcast, do share the link and subscribe to our channel. So until next time, see you and thank you.